The first case is 96-1149, State of Ohio versus Kevin Keith. Mr. Reinhardt.
Did you bring any breakfast? Did you bring any breakfast? I'm hungry. Between the guilt stage and the penalty stage?
Yes, Your Honor.
You said you were going to start with the mitigation stage.
That's correct.
I guess I was going to ask, are you conceding conviction?
No, not at all. And the point that I'd like to make before I get into the substantive issues that we have raised is that unlike the last case that I argued before this court, this is not a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt. Indeed, the evidence of the identity of the perpetrator in this case is quite underwhelming. This case has some of the most bizarre testimony I have read in my 18 years of law. I would direct, of course, attention to the testimony of Richard Warren, a victim and survivor of this assault. Richard Warren could not identify the perpetrator of this event within minutes of being assaulted at Hyatt's restaurant. He did not conform with the name, either first or last, at that point. His testimony was that the perpetrator entered the apartment where he was staying with one of the other victims with a turtleneck sweater pulled up over his nose and proceeded to drink two glasses water through the turtleneck sweater, then to pull a gun out of the garbage bag and open fire. According to the testimony at trial, Mr. Warren was able to come up with the name of Kevin Keith after what I can only describe as a name lineup, where he was asked four last names, two of which the police officers were able to recall, and two of which they were unable to recall. And according to the police officer doing this name lineup, he said he was 75% sure the last name Kevin was Keith. According to his testimony, he was 100% sure.
But he did, counsel, I understand, he did have the name, the first name, Kevin, from the scene in the living room.
That is not at all clear. His testimony at trial was that that one of the victims was still the name of the perpetrator, but that he could only remember Kevin. However, again, when he was asked at Ike's restaurant immediately after the incident, he said he didn't know who did it. His testimony about how he came up with the name was that at the he was taking the grant emergency where he was administered to by medical professionals. He couldn't speak, and his hands were restrained. Yet nevertheless, he attempted to use sign language to sign to a nurse the name Kevin.
The name is an additional, that's, I guess, in terms of identification, it was the name, and in this with a somewhat a name lineup in a way. But is that of less importance than the other physical identification? I mean, this Mr. Wagner did identify from a photo array as well.
Well, Richard Warren, whose English we're talking about, was shown a photographic array. However, suspect almost immediately. You can see a transcript page, pages 661, 798, and also 215. Kevin Thomas fits the same general description that they had. He was a large black man.
Where did Kevin Thomas's name come from?
Kevin Thomas's name came from, I believe it was Stanley. Was it Stanley?
Someone at the scene?
I'm sorry, Dane. Yes, law enforcement at the scene, who was familiar with Kevin Thomas as being involved in drug-related activities.
Were they?
As being an African-American.
Was that person involved in the apartment or the place of the crime?
Well, we don't know if he was a suspect at the time. And the point that I was trying to make was that no photo of this individual was ever shown to any of the survivors of the crime, even though he was a suspect at the time.
Just trying to determine whether from the survivors there was any confusion between Kevin Thomas and the other Kevin.
Well, there certainly could have been.
Where was there? There was not.
Well, we don't know because they were never shown the photo, Your Honor.
So there was no confusion. Is that they were never shown anything? There was no confusion.
Well,
he's trying to interject confusion from people who were not involved in the affray and saying that that's the person that the people that were involved were confused with.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that you're asserting the conclusion.
So are you.
The point I'm trying to make is we don't know if there was confusion. There was never an opportunity given to the witnesses. There should have been this basic fundamental law enforcement thing. We do not assume that one or two or three suspects is the perpetrator. You investigate, you try and find out. If you have a suspect, you show witnesses a photo of that suspect. You show, in this case, you should have been at least two, maybe three photo arrays containing all the suspects that they had no time to. That was not done. Again, Perry Walker, half-brother of the defendant, lived at this area. He also fits the same general description. He was identified by people being at the scene at the time. His photo was never shown. The point of, and let me also mention Nancy Smathers, the other eyewitness witness. She was interviewed, again, on the night of the incident, said that she could not identify the individual. Subsequently, after she saw Kevin Keith on television, after he had been arrested, she came forward and said, well, now I'm sure that that's the individual. She also testified at the scene that there were two or three African-American men that came home, and I believe one of them was defense counsel, James Banks. As I said, this case contains some of the most bizarre testimony that I've read in 18 years of practicing law. And the point I'm trying to make by that rendition of the facts is that the question of the identity of the perpetrator is not resolved to my confidence or I think to the confidence of the lay neutral observer.
Is it your contention then that Warren is not a reliable witness? I mean, here's a man.
I feel confident in making that statement.
You do? Now, here's a man who was in the same room when Keith comes in. Keith asks him about the football game on television. They have a discourse on the water and all that sort of thing. And then Keith tells them all to lie down. He watches as he puts a gun to the girlfriend's head, watches him slaughter the child and another person, then shoots at Warren, and Warren's dripping blood or flowing blood as he's looking at his assailant. When he sees even the assailant, he even described, as I recall, the 9mm gun or cannon that was taken out of the bag. How can he not be a reliable witness? Then whenever he gets up and runs because he's not dead, Keith chases him and shoots him in the buttocks and knocks him over in the snow again. Now, how can that not be reliable?
Well, Your Honor, he had lived in that apartment for some 2 weeks with the mother of the two children. He could not remember either of the children's names. Both Quinton Reeves, who was showing a picture of Kevin Keith in the photo lineup, and said, that is not the person. picked out Kevin Keith's photo and brought to his attention. He said, well, that kind of looks like it, but that's not the person. The children said that they knew the perpetrator of the offense. The perpetrator of the offense was Daddy's friend, Bruce. Bruce Melton is one of the individuals. There's another Bruce that's involved here. Both of whom were related to the children. Your Honor, there is, at best, the best that can be said about the evidence of communication in this case is that it is equivocal.
We'll talk about the car then, the car that suddenly appears within 2 weeks after Brady visits him in jail, and the tires had been changed after the time of the occurrence to new tires on a car, the license plate impression in the snow.
Rodney Melton had a car fitting the same general description that was taken at the scene. He also had a license plate with the same three numbers on it. There's some question about where the numbers were positioned on the license plate. However, no one ever bothered to go retrieve Rodney Melton's license plate to determine if the numbers were positioned in the same place as they think the numbers were from the suppression that they took in the snow and the snowbank. Your Honor, there is no unequivocal evidence in this case. There is evidence that Kevin Keith was the perpetrator. There is also evidence, I would suggest substantial, that he is not. The point that I'm trying to make before, and I don't want to spend a great deal of time speaking to the facts because we have gone to great lengths to detail those information, is that this is not a case of overwhelming evidence of guilt. And the reason I bring that up is because this court has made it quite clear in any number of cases that the degree of evidence, the degree to which the evidence of guilt is great is important to a number of tests that this court applies to legal issues that are raised, not the least of which is the question of plain error. And we feel a great deal of that in this case. Having said that, let me shift the court's focus and attention to the mitigation phase of this trial. Court, bear with me, I shall read to the court the entire mitigation phase of the case when the state of Ohio prosecuted Kevin Keith. Court, counsel for the defendant, you may proceed with, counsel for the defendant, you may proceed with his opening statement, Mr. Banks. Your Honor, my client is not desirous of making any statement with regard to this issue. The court, all right, the state may proceed. Mr. Wise, we have nothing to present, sir. That is the mitigation phase.
Is that the state's fault?
No.
I mean, we're getting to the place in these cases where when you come in and argue this, that if the state and or the prosecutor doesn't also prepare the case and try it for the defendant, that it's error.
No, that is not the issue the point that I'm trying to make with this proposition. And let me say at this point that I am not pleased with the way this issue is briefed. And I would suggest to the court may amend the proposal. Argument memorandum on this issue. But it is our position that in a situation where it appears to the court that the defendant does not want to proceed with mediation, the court must engage in a personal colloquy with the defendant to determine that his waiver or her waiver of that right is being made in a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary manner, the same way the court would engage in a colloquy if the defendant sought to plead guilty or to contest, or to have counsel with potential conflict, any of the number.
But isn't that second-guessing the defense attorney? There are many instances when a judge steps in and we hear arguments from the defense that the judge is overstepping his role, his or her role. Wouldn't that be the same thing? Where is the authority for requiring a judge to do this?
Well, okay, there's two questions. Let me respond to the first one, Jeff. No, it's not second guessing, it's first guessing. And what I mean by that is the court has to satisfy itself that certain advices have been given to the client, that he understands them, and that he argument in the brief that this is a right, constitutional right, of the nature that it cannot be vicariously waived for the defendant. It has to be personally waived by the defendant. We made that specific argument, which is case law for rights that are analogous in
What constitutional, to what section of the Constitution is this as under the general auspices of the imposition of death penalty, or what specifically do you point to as this equating with the constitutional right on to present mitigation evidence in a death penalty case?
Well,
this is not a psychological evaluation. It contains numerous misstatements of law.
discussion, you should look familiar to the court, because what this Dr. Schoenberg is doing here is citing the free lockup law in the state of Ohio, where death was precluded if any of the three mitigating factors were present. And indeed, this psychological evaluation also contains the examiner's opinion, I bet those are his words, not mine, that there are no mitigating factors in this case. But a psychological evaluation may be important to the jury on a number of bases, but the opinion of the evaluator that there are no mitigating factors is wholly inappropriate. That's the jury's decision. We have delineated the numerous misstatements of law in this. I would point out to the court that this document has all the trappings of an official document, stands confidential on the front. It was a document that the jury paid a great deal of attention to. We can judge that from the number of questions that the jury had. The jury came back and very insightfully asked a number of questions about the misstatements of fact in the pre-sentence investigation. In effect, the jury corrected the court and counsel on a number of these things. It simply cannot be presumed that this psychological evaluation of these numerous gross inaccuracies of the law in Ohio is to not factor into the sentencing calculus, and certainly destroys any confidence that the review court can have in the reliability of that process. I'm jumping around a bit now. There is a reason for that. And I want to direct the court's attention, prior to addressing the question of ineffective assistance, I want to direct the court's attention to the videotape. Impeachment of Grace Keith, the sole alibi that was presented during this is. This is the fifth proposition of law. Before I do that, I want to point out to the court that no videotapes were admitted into the record in this case. However, it appears that there are two videotapes that are physically with the record in this case. And I would caution the court that those items have not been admitted into the record in this case. Indeed, it's the fact that the videotape was not admitted that caused any number of legal problems for the state. The prosecution wanted to impeach Grace with an inconsistent statement that she had made to the news media, allegedly inconsistent statement. And the prosecution did ask the appropriate questions of Grace during her testimony when he cross-examined her. However, when the prosecution sought to use this evidence extrinsic to her testimony to impeach her on a collateral issue, the prosecution failed to authenticate the tape. There is simply no authentication of this tape. In addition, because the prosecution wanted to
is
use...
Is this a plain error? Again, is this plain error? There was no objection to defense counsel raise authenticity issue?
Did he raise authenticity? No. Was an objection made on a general hearsay basis? Yes. The court's ruling on the hearsay objection is probably correct, but the trial court's attention to this area of error was directed. Nevertheless, I think that the court ultimately will decide it has to address this on a plain error basis. Again, in a case where the evidence of guilt is underwhelmed. There is no authentication whatsoever. Indeed, the evidence in the case is that this was not the original tape, but a copy, a concatenation of various television interviews of this case. In addition, before the court has transcribe what she heard from the videotape when the videotape was played to the jury. Initially, the tape's not queued up to the right place. The judge said stop and asked the jury to turn around and look at the wall while they queued it up to the proper place. And then it was played to the jury. The transcript of the playing of the videotape does not bear out the impeachment. If you look at what the court reporter has transcribed, it contains no inconsistent statement by Grace Keith. Now, this error, if it is indeed error, as we have proposed, cannot be harmless. It is plain, and the reason for that is that the sole defense presented was alibi, and the sole alibi was presented was Grace Keith.
And yet, if you're saying that it's not, that it really didn't impeach her, and that it wasn't inconsistent with her testimony on direct, doesn't that sort of bear towards the harmless error side?
Well, the case should have been described that one because the prosecution had represented to the jury both explicitly and implicitly that Grace Keith indeed had said that.
Mm-hmm. But if the jury didn't hear, apparently that tape did not support what the prosecution said it would support, and therefore, and there was no motion for this time.
The jury could very well have concluded that the failure was theirs. They simply didn't understand what the tape was and simply relied on the prosecution. It comes into the court with the trappings of the sovereign. Has made a personal representation in cross-examination.
Yeah, but, you know, we instruct against that. I mean, you're really asking for a supposition that's really so opposite of the normal supposition that they will follow the instructions to say that what the counsel says isn't, you know, and that plus the tape didn't say what you would think it would really undermine the prosecution case and statements by the prosecutor rather than work against the defendant.
Well, I would ask if the court is confident that occurred in this case. I would direct the court's attention to the jury questions that were returned by the jury. The jury said, we want to see the videotape of Grace Keith. And the court responded to that, well, no, the tape wasn't admitted into evidence, so I'm not going to show it to you. And he came back with another question. They said, if the tape wasn't admitted into evidence, why was it shown to us?
Did the court preview the tape prior to the use of it by anybody?
It does not. I do not know the answer to that question. Of record, it does not appear so, but I do not know the answer to that question.
Counsel, your time's running down, and you want to get to ineffective. Is ineffective counsel your strongest argument?
Your Honor, the strongest argument as a matter of law is the failure of the court's engagement. The complement to ensure that the waiver of recommendations, no result at all. That is an issue I'm confident will prevail on this court, federal court. Ineffective assistance of counsel runs a close second because of numerous failures of counsel that are not of record in this case. To point out that the post-conviction petition has been filed, another issue. And I would like to reserve the remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Reinhart. Mr. Wiseman.
Hey, please, the court. I am Russell Wiseman. I'm the prosecuting attorney. The state disagrees with the appellant as to the weight of the evidence in this case. And we believe that fair viewing of the evidence in this case is important to several of the other issues that the appellant raises, for instance, the failure of counsel to engage in mitigation. At the outset, we would note that they can't have it both ways. On the one hand, appellant argues that counsel did nothing in mitigation, equating it to this court's opinion in the case of Wisconsin, where it was clear from the record that absolutely nothing was done. And the court did send that back. Or for this case,
to what's your response to the argument that this waiver of mitigation, not, I know you say there was no waiver, but there was no argument. What's your response to the view posed here by the counsel for the defendant that this is the equivalent of a waiver of a right to a trial by jury and thereby requires the court to question in like manner the knowing waiver?
Justice Cook, our response to that is, quite frankly, that the right of the defendant to have the opportunity to present mitigating evidence does not rise to the same fundamental right as the right to appeal, the right to a plea. And indeed, if you look at appellant's brief, they are unable to cite any cases that reset left. You know, they do cite the cases that go to Wayne versus Alabama in the guilty plea, Adams versus the United States, whether they pursue an appeal, or rather waiver jury trial. And but they want this court to raise the opportunity to present mitigation evidence to that same level. If you look at the federal court's decision in State versus, Machine versus Reynolds, they clearly recognize two forms of rights. Rights can be waived by counsel, and those rights are so fundamental that the court must make personal inquiry to defend. Quite simply, the right to have an opportunity to present mitigation doesn't rise to that level. We think it's especially important in a case like this that the court look at the totality of the circumstances that existed at the time the mitigation phase started. Judge Posner, in a federal court case, essentially indicated that you have to look at what counsel's position was. What could he have done? We must remember that the jury who was going to hear this mitigation evidence had just returned a guilty verdict of three counts of murder, the execution-style murder of two women and a seven-year-old child, and attempted murder convictions against two other children, four and seven, and a young adult, the same juror. To say that without any support, that counsel for the defendant could have, should have, or even had something to present that would outweigh the aggravating factors is a big jump.
Counsel, does the trial court have an obligation to see that the defendant receives a fair trial?
Of course, Your Honor.
All right. Does the court have an obligation that to him it appears defense counsel is somewhat inadequate to interject himself into that trial?
I would agree.
You agree with both those things?
I would agree that if the court is on notice and does have a legitimate reason to suspect that counsel is deficient, that they should inquire. Yes. However, we disagree that that occurred in the case given the context.
I'm concerned about the lack of activity by defense counsel on the mitigation case. Now, doesn't the trial court, in seeing those activities, have a legal obligation to inquire, at least in chambers, with counsel and the defendant, that they have discussed this and they know what they're doing?
Justice Sweeney, you mentioned in chambers.
Out of the hearing of the jury, let's put that in chambers offends you. Let's just say it's out of hearing of the jury. Sidebar, wherever you want to have it, I don't care.
I can't stand here and say that couldn't happen and that the question is,
should it happen?
Well, I don't believe it necessarily should happen when the court from having sat through the trial, having observed the defendant's relationship with his counsel, having counsel stand up and represent to the court that my client doesn't want to make a statement, standing up in front of his client and saying, we have nothing to present
wouldn't it take you sitting on the bench a little bit by surprise if that happened in your court?
It would in certain cases, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that necessitate the court in at least inquiring for his own peace of mind whether or not this was being done according to the law and according to the wishes of the defendant?
Again, if we take it in isolation, just look at the facts you've described to me in the mitigation phase, I can see where a person would conclude or review in court that...
I'm just trying to determine whether, in your mind, the trial court, who is obligated to see that the defendant gets a fair trial, has an obligation himself to inquire into this type of activity. That's all I'm getting to.
My answer to that is...
Do you agree that he does?
I agree that he has an obligation to see that he has a fair trial, but I also believe you have to view that obligation in the context of this trial. This is a judge that sat through some 3 weeks of trial who observed the relationship between the defendant and his counsel, who observed, contrary to Pellis, disingenuous allegations.
So by those comments, you must have me assume what the court assumed they talked this over.
I'm not representing that the court talked it over.
Well, you're saying by the conduct between the parties, by the activities of the parties during the trial, so you're intimating to me that they had thorough discussions during trial, so I must assume that they discussed this conduct with counsel and he agreed to it by their prior activities.
Are you referring to the defendant conferring with counsel or the court referring to
that? Well, now, shouldn't it be nice if that's what the defendant wants to do?
That's
and should
true.
The court make sure that that's what the defendant wants to do?
Not in this case, necessarily.
Not in this case. Not if
this court has discussed in State versus Johnson that this is a matter of trial tactics. I don't believe this court has now or should involve itself in every aspect of trial tactics. As long as the opportunity to present mitigation does not rise to the fundamental rights, such as we discussed before, I don't believe the court should necessarily interfere. The court, I think, has an independent duty to inquire when it does observe something that clearly puts it on notice that something's amiss. And that's what I was referring to.
So you feel in this case that nothing happened that would cause the court to do this?
I feel very strongly, Your Honor, that in that courtroom, there was no doubt in the court's mind that this is what the defendant wanted.
Okay.
And that is why it's not quite.
What would the tactic be that would suggest that no mitigation be offered on behalf of a defendant who's facing a death sentence?
I still look at the case from the defense perspective, Mr. Chief Justice, but...
Well, put yourself in the place of a trial judge, as we have to do in this case, and decide whether the trial judge erred to the prejudice of the defendant. That here's a lawyer who didn't appear to be the most aggressive lawyer on behalf of his client, and the trial judge sees the lawyer say nothing, offer nothing on behalf of his client in mitigation. I guess if it's tactics, and oftentimes it is tactics, as you know, we write that. I'm just needing some help in knowing what tactical advantage would be served for a defendant facing the death penalty by not offering any mitigation, even if it isn't persuasive. I mean, it would seem that maybe something might catch with the jury.
I could say this to that, Your Honor. First off, at the risk of contradicting you, I think the record, a fair reading of the record, does reveal a vigorous and active defense on the part of Pellis counsel. There's a tendency on the part of Pellis here in his brief, because they're dissatisfied with the mitigation phase, to throw that back and say counsel did nothing throughout the trial. A reading of the transcript reveals extensive cross-examination, two alibi witnesses, numerous witnesses presented in the defense case, hammering away at the lack of scientific evidence that links the defendant to the crime, questioning of every witness. This attorney had the benefit of an 80-some page police report, which the court, as it reads the transcript, will find they make full use of. Now, the mitigation phase, given that context, it could be a reasonable trial tactic at that point in time to not present evidence that would somehow be used against him.
Counsel, let's turn to the Chief Justice's question. Back at you. What in this case did you reasonably have planned to respond if there was such a presentation that counsel might have been aware of? In other words, was there a response that was readily known to defense counsel that made proceeding perilous?
There was certainly Justice Pfeiffer, the fact that the defendant had a prior conviction ended up in the report anyway, conviction of violent crime. There wasn't, other than that conviction, there wasn't a lot in the background that would add to the factors, but to be honest with you, if you look at the nature of the crime there, it's hard for me to imagine what, if anything, in any of our backgrounds could outweigh what had occurred here. We had an execution-style slaying of three people and an attempt to slay three others in a most ruthless and calculated fashion. It's hard to imagine what, if anything, in mitigation could outweigh those aggravating circumstances.
Without arguing your case for you, isn't there even a better answer to the Chief Justice's question, maybe Justice Pfeiffer's question? And that is, in State v. DePue, we made very clear that you can present your whole case, if they present mitigation, your whole case all over again in the mitigation phase. So we would have, the jury might very well have then heard about the three murders, the other two people that the kids had just barely escaped, and the fourth person who did get shot. All of that would have come up in the mitigation phase. But even more pertinent to that, in State v. Post, where we indicate that we have reversed State v. Johnson, we said that we did so after determining defense counsel did not discuss the penalty phase with his client. Is there anything in this record that shows that the defense counsel did not discuss the penalty phase with his client?
No, sir. There is something next, in the brief.
I just asked you, is there anything in the record that shows that counsel did not discuss the penalty phase with his client?
Not that I'm aware.
All right. Next, had little time to present evidence of mitigating factors. Anything in the record that shows he had insufficient time to present a mitigation case?
No, sir.
And finally, did he, during the guilt stage and then the mitigation stage, did he display a lack of preparation?
No, sir.
And those are the criteria that we set in Post for the reasons for reversing Johnson on the basis of the mitigation phase being weak.
Counsel, could you address, you know, the defendant has suggested that in our review of a lot of the potential errors under a plain error standard, that the evidence of guilt and particularly the identification here of this defendant is underwhelming. And we suggest the children had a different ID, that we have Gracie Keith and the problems with that tape, which are problems. What do you say?
Well, Justice Cook, we disagree at first strongly with the characterization of the identification evidence as weak or underwhelming. In the first place, it's not clear at all that the same principles apply to a name identification, that a preliminary part of the investigation to try to focus an investigation, that the same principles apply to that as they do a photo frame. One case, I think the Tobar case, federal case, addressed that issue, but the court declined to actually come to a conclusion because they found that procedure use was not suggested.
What evidence in this case shows definitively we have the right person.
We have the evidence of Richard Warren, the eyewitness, as Justice Sweeney mentioned earlier, or Justice Douglas. He was in the room, he had not observed.
Okay.
Counsel would have us believe that right after the event, he didn't know who did it. I would point out shot twice in the back, once in the jaw, was able to run from the apartment. When he was observed by the defendant, he ran after him and shot him again.
We got that. So you have his testimony.
His testimony. We also have the identification of Nancy Smathers, who observed the defendant outside her apartment when his car was stuck in the snowdrift. He got out of the car and he rocked the car out. She identified him in court. And I should back up a second. Richard Warren independently came up with the name Kevin at the hospital.
And is Kevin Thompson someone who would be a legitimate, I mean, did he have any connection with this case? Was he involved in the same alleged drug bust that
it's not in the record. There's nothing in the record that connects it. It's possible in reality, of course. But the testimony of Richard Warren was that he inquired as to the identity of the man that came to the apartment. He was told the name was Kevin and forgot the last name, that he had just been involved in a great big drug bust. That is accurate as to Kevin Keith, but not accurate as to Kevin Thomas. Kevin Keith was under indictment, represented by the same lawyer who represented him in this case, and for cocaine trafficking. And it was the relative of the victims who had been used as a police informant. That is a matter of record of the trial. So the motive, the identification, and the other evidence, the car, for instance, the court mentioned the tire tube change, the lights displayed impressions in the snow. Counsel would have us believe that Mr. Melton, who had a car with 03043, could have been in the impression was backwards. The license plate was one that Melton had the numbers and the letters the other way around. If you look at the impression in snow, you don't have to be a BCI forensic chemist to know that that license plate could not have made the impression. So, our answer to the appellant is that there is overwhelming evidence in this case of the defendant's guilt, and nothing in this case arises to plain error.
The children independently named someone else?
The evidence was that there was a child who called the shooter Bruce. There was also testimony that the appellant objects to as hearsay that she had mistaken the defendant for Bruce on previous occasions. Her mother testified that to her, she called the man Bruce. So whether or not that is conclusive, I don't know. But it certainly explains why the wrong name was used when she identified the defendant. The issue of the videotape, if I might briefly, it's important, I think, in this context of this assignment, to remember that this was done on a rebuttal and for impeachment. The appellant concedes that everything was done properly as to commenting, giving the witness a chance to deny the statement, and those theoretic criteria that are required. Their complaint is that at the time it was published, it wasn't properly authenticated. And our position is that the rule that allows extrinsic evidence for the purpose of impeachment is a different type of rule than the one to authenticate something that's actually used to prove the contents. This was not used to prove the contents of the tape. It was used simply in rebuttal to prove that the witness, at least at one other time, made an inconsistent statement.
Was this was a videotape, was it not?
Justice Stratton, what we had was we had subpoenaed the news footage of the coverage of the trial. And along with the news footage, we got that subpoena. We got the videotape and transcripts prepared by the news media. What I had in court was a transcript prepared by the news media to receive along with Shania.
So was the videotape played for the witness to look at?
No. The videotape was played after the witness's office stand in the rebuttal phase.
So the witness was not on the stand looking at the videotape and saying, that's not me. Was the witness ever recalled by the process of the defense to say, that wasn't me, or they take me wrong, or anything of that sort?
No. And
Thank you, Mr. Wiseman. Mr. Reinhart, you've just about used your time, but take a minute. I'm sorry, Mr. Cockley.
Yeah,
Mr. Reinhart saved you 37 seconds, but I'll give you a, you can start with a minute, see where that gets you.
Your Honor, there is discovery in criminal cases, and I know with interest that the counsel for the defendant never once filed any mitigation witnesses on any type of discovery list. The biggest issue facing this court is going to be this waiver, attempted waiver by counsel for the defendant of his right to present mitigation evidence. There's absolutely no tactical strategy that this court can discern from that waiver. If this was such
what about the point that in mitigation the prosecution can essentially retry the case and present to the jury again the facts of this case, which aren't very pleasant?
To respond to that, when the defendant puts on no mitigation, all that jury has before it is what was already presented and what they already found the defendant guilty of beyond a reasonable doubt, including the death specifications. To fail to put on any mitigation is an election to die, because that jury has nothing else to do. And yes, I agree that the state can relitigate its entire case to try and once again inflame the passion of the jury to seek a death. But when you have a close factual case, at a minimum, you should be arguing residual doubt. And this court, I think, is going to have to confront this issue. The trial court has an obligation
to counsel. Residual doubt, which I've written about, hasn't been too warmly received by my colleagues.
Well,
that's a pretty...
Only by a minority of your colleagues.
We're still the majority, doesn't it?
I mean, that's a pretty thin thread to hang on. Let me flip that around and ask this. If you're in the deep hole with Mr. Keith and his counsel were in at the conclusion of the first phase of the trial, could it even be a tactic for Theo to...
You're suggesting invited error by counsel?
I'm wondering.
You're suggesting that, Judge? Then this court ought to step in and make sure that doesn't happen. Like just what we were talking about here, the court stopping right there and saying, time out, gang, we have a man here facing the death penalty. And counsel, I'm going to inquire of you, I am going to inquire of your client, be it in chambers, out of the presence of the jury, to make sure, like this court here did in State versus Berry, that there's a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver. If the man wants to die, we ought to make sure he knows what he's doing.
What mitigation would you have suggested they said based on what we read in the both reports that were given to the jury?
Well, Your Honor, I certainly wouldn't have submitted those reports to that jury if I was in the deep hole that Justice Baker suggested
that
we were in. I mean, you got the pilgrim strapped to the cross. You don't go out gathering the fire.
But what would you have presented? I'm getting to my question. What would you have presented?
Your Honor, there was never an indication done in this case. There was never any preparation. There's not one discovery witness listed by the defendant in any form or shape presented.
I understand that, but what would you have done that would have made a difference? That's the issue we have to get to. Would anything have made a difference in this man's background? We don't have any evidence of the mental defect, do we?
It's outside the record, but it's all contained in the post-conviction petition that my co-counsel have already filed in the case. All kinds of evidence. The fact that Kevin Keith was a high school football star, he won a state championship, he came from a broken home, he grew up within several different families. There's a litany of things that are available in the post-conviction that no one even touched upon. And the post-conviction, and that PSI, that psychological evaluation, that was the worst thing someone could have done. That, I think, demonstrates on the record the plain error, the ineffective assistance. And at a minimum, requires a remand for an inquiry into whether there was a knowing and voluntary waiver. This record is absolutely silent. In fact, it goes beyond that. It goes to the aggravator. Because by requesting a PSI, by requesting that psychological evaluation, without objection to any of the inaccuracies and usurpation of legal authority by the people that generated those reports, and then sending them to the jury that's already convicted this man and found the aggravating circumstances beyond a reasonable doubt, Who pounded nails in Mr. Keith's coffin?
You need to sum up, Mr. Cockley. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.